So they shoved and pushed and clawed her down, that unseen nefarious crowd in the city, and Jeff held on to her, and they writhed and twisted at his grip, and then, well, that's just the queer thing about the mining business. Why, sudden as a flash of lightning, it seemed, the news came over the wire to the Mariposa News Packet that they had struck a vein of silver in the Northern Star as thick as a sidewalk, and that the stock had jumped to $17 a share. And even at that, you couldn't get it. And Jeff stood there, flushed and half staggered, against the mirror of the little shop, with a bunch of mining scrip in his hands that was worth $40,000. Excitement. It was all over the town in minutes. They ran off a news extra at the Mariposa News Packet, and in less than no time, there wasn't standing room at the barber shop. And over at Smith's Hotel, they had three extra barkeeps working on the lager beer pumps. They were selling mining shares on the main street in Mariposa that afternoon, and people were just clutching for them. Then, at night, there was a big oyster supper in Smith's Caff, with speeches and the Mariposa band outside. And the queer thing was that the very next afternoon was the funeral of young Fizzlechip, and Dean Drone had to change the whole text of his Sunday sermon at 2 days' notice for fear of offending any public sentiment. But I think what Jeff liked best of it all was the sort of public recognition that it meant. He'd stand there in the shop, hardly bothering to shave, and explain to the men in the armchairs how he'd held her, and they shoved her, and he clung to her, and what he'd said to himself, a perfect Iliad, while he was clinging to her. The whole thing was in the city papers a few days after, with a photograph of Jeff, taken specially at Ed Moore's studio, upstairs over Netley's. It showed Jeff sitting among palm trees, as all mining men do, with one hand on his knee, and a dog, one of those regular mining dogs, at his feet, and a look of piercing intelligence in his face that would easily account for $40,000. I say that the recognition meant a lot to Jeff for its own sake, but no doubt the fortune meant quite a bit to him, too, on account of Myra. Did I mention Myra, Jeff's daughter? Perhaps not. That's the trouble with the people in Mariposa. They're all so separate and so different, not a bit like the people in the cities, that unless you hear about them separately and one by one, you can't for a moment understand what they're like. Myra had golden hair and a Greek face and would come bursting through the barber shop in a hat at least 6 inches wider than what they wear in Paris. As you saw her swinging up the street to the telephone exchange in a suit that was straight from the delineator, and brown American boots, there was style written all over her, the kind of thing that Mariposa recognized and did homage to. And to see her in the exchange, she was one of the four girls I spoke of, on her high stool, with a steel cap on, jabbing the connecting plugs in and out as if electricity cost nothing. Well, all I mean is that you could understand why it was that the commercial travelers would stand round in the exchange, calling up all sorts of impossible villages, and waiting about so pleasant and genial, it made one realize how naturally good-tempered men are. And then when Myra would go off duty, and Miss Cleghorn, who was sallow, would come on, the commercial men would be off again like autumn leaves. It just shows the difference between people. There was Myra, who treated lovers like dogs, and would slap them across the face with a banana skin to show her utter independence. And there was Miss Cleghorn, who was sallow, and who bought a 40-cent ancient history to improve herself. Yet, if she hit any man in Mariposa with a banana skin, he'd have had her arrested for assault. Mind you, I don't mean that Myra was merely flippant and worthless. Not at all. She was a girl with any amount of talent. You should have heard her recite The Raven at the Methodist Social. Simply genius. And when she acted Portia in the trial scene of The Merchant of Venice at the high school concert, everybody in Mariposa admitted that you couldn't have told it from the original. So, of course, as soon as Jeff made the fortune, Myra had her resignation in the next morning, and everybody knew that she was to go to a dramatic school for 3 months in the fall and become a leading actress. But, as I said, the public recognition counted a lot for Jeff. The moment you begin to get that sort of thing, it comes in quickly enough. Brains, you know, are recognized right away. That was why, of course, within a week of this, Jeff received this first big packet of stuff from the Cuban Land Development Company, with colored pictures of Cuba, and fields of bananas, and haciendas, and insurrectos with machetes and heaven knows what. They heard of him somehow. It wasn't for a modest man like Jefferson to say how. After all, the capitalists of the world are just one and the same crowd. If you're in it, you're in it. That's all. Jeff realized why it is that, of course, men like Carnegie or Rockefeller and Morgan all know one another. They have to. For all I know, this Cuban stuff may have been sent from Morgan himself. Some of the people in Mariposa said yes, others said no. There was no certainty. Anyway, they were fair and straight, this Cuban crowd that wrote to Jeff. They offered him to come right in and be one of themselves. If a man's got the brains, you may as well recognize it straight away. Just as well write him to be a director now as wait and hesitate till he forces his way into it. Anyhow, they didn't hesitate, these Cuban people that wrote to Jeff from Cuba or from a post office box in New York. It's all the same thing, because Cuba being so near New York, the mail is all distributed from there. I suppose in some financial circles they might have been slower, wanted guarantees of some sort, and so on. But these Cubans, you know, have got a sort of Spanish warmth of heart that you don't see in businessmen in America. And that touches you. No, they ask no guarantee. Just send the money, whether by express order or bank draft or check. They left that entirely up to oneself, as a matter between Cuban gentlemen. And they were quite frank about their enterprise. Bananas and tobacco and the plantation district reclaimed from the insurrectives. You could see it all there in the pictures. Tobacco plants and the insurrectos, everything. They made no rash promises, just admitted straight out that the enterprise may realize 400%, or might conceivably make less. There was no hint of more. So, within a month, everybody in Mariposa knew that Jeff Thorpe was in Cuban lands and would probably clean up a half million by New Year's. You couldn't have failed to know it. All round the little shop, there were pictures of banana groves and the harbor of Havana and Cubans in white suits and scarlet sashes smoking cigarettes in the sun, too ignorant to know that you could make 400% by planting a banana tree. I liked it about Jeff that he didn't stop shaving. He went on just the same. Even when Johnson, the livery stable man, came in with $500 and asked him to see if the Cuban board of directors would let him put it in, Jeff laid it in the drawer and then shaved him for 5 cents in the same old way. Of course, he must have felt proud when, a few days later, he got a letter from the Cuban people in New York accepting the money straight off without a single question and without knowing anything more about Johnson except that he was a friend of Jeff's. They wrote most handsomely. Any friend of Jeff's were friends of Cuba. All money they might send would be treated just as Jeff's would be treated. One reason, perhaps, why Jeff didn't give up shaving was because it allowed him to talk about Cuba. You see, everybody knew in Mariposa that Jeff Thorpe had sold out of Cobalts and had gone into Cuban renovated lands, and that spread round him a kind of a halo of wealth and mystery and outlandishness. Oh, something Spanish. Perhaps you felt it about people that you know. Anyhow, they asked him about the climate and the yellow fever and what the Negroes were like and all that sort of thing. This Cuba, it appears, is an island, Jeff would explain. Of course, everybody knows how easily islands lend themselves to making money. And for fruit, they say, it comes up so fast you can't stop it. And then he would pass into details about the hash-enders and the resurrectos and technical things like that, till it was thought a wonder how he could know it. Still, it was realized that a man with money has got to know these things. Look at Morgan and Rockefeller and the men that make a pile. They know just as much as Jeff did about the countries where they made it. It stands to reason. Did I say that Jeff shaved in the same old way? Not quite. There was something even dreamier about it now, and a sort of new element in the way Jeff fell out of his monotone into lapses of thought that I, for one, misunderstood. I thought that perhaps getting so much money, well, you know the way it acts on people in the larger cities. It seems to spoil one's idea of Jeff's that copper and asbestos and banana lands should form the goal of his thoughts, when, if he knew it, the little shop and the sunlight of Mariposa was so much better. In fact, I had perhaps borne him a grudge for what seemed to me his perpetual interest in the great capitalist. He always had some item out of the paper about them. I see where this Carnegie has given $50,000 for one of them observatories, he would say. And another day he would pause in the course of shaving and almost whisper, "Did you ever see this Rockefeller?" It was only by sort of accident that I came to know that there was another side of Jefferson's speculation that no one in Mariposa ever knew or will ever know. I knew it because I went to see Jeff in his house one night. The house, I think I said it, stood out behind the barber shop. You went out of the back door of the shop and through a grass plot with petunias beside it, and the house stood at the end. You could see the light of the lamp behind the blind and through the screen door as you came along. And it was there that Jefferson used to sit in the evenings when the shop got empty. There was a round table that the woman used to lay for supper, and after supper there used to be a checkered cloth on it and a lamp with a shade, and beside it Jeff would sit with his spectacles and the paper spread out, reading about Carnegie and Rockefeller. Near him, but away from the table, was the woman doing needlework, and Myra, when she wasn't working at the telephone exchange, was there too with her elbows on the table, reading Marie Corelli. Only now, of course, after the fortune, she was reading prospectuses of dramatic schools. So this night, I don't know just what it was in the paper that caused it, Jeff laid down what he was reading and started to talk about Carnegie. "This Carnegie, I bet you, would be worth," said Jeff, closing up his eyes in calculation, "as much as perhaps $2 million if he was to sell him up. And this Rockefeller and this Morgan, either of them, to sell them up clean, would be worth another couple million." I may say, in parentheses, that this was a favorite method in Mariposa, if you wanted to get at the real worth of a man, to imagine him clean sold up, put up for auction, as it were. It was the only way to test him. "And now look at them," Jeff went on. "They make their money, and what do they do with it? They give it away. And who do they give it to? Why, to those who don't want it, every time. They give it to these professors, and to this research and that. And do the poor get any of it? Not a cent, and never will. I tell you, boys," continued Jeff, there were no boys present, but in Mariposa, all really important speeches were addressed to an imaginary audience of boys, "I tell you, if I was to make a million out of this cubie, I'd give it straight to the poor, yes, sir, divide it up into 100 lots of $1,000 each, and give it to the people that had nothing." So always after that, I knew just what those bananas were being grown for. Indeed, after that, though Jefferson never spoke of his intentions directly, he said a number of things that seemed to bear on them. He asked me, for instance, one day, how many blind people it would take to fill one of these blind homes, and how a feller could get a hold of 'em. And another time he asked whether if a feller advertised for some of these incurables, a feller could get enough of them to make a showing. I know for a fact that he got Nivens, the lawyer, to draw up a document that was to give an acre of banana land in Cuba to every idiot in Massanabba County. But still, what's the use of talking what Jeff meant to do? Nobody knows or cares about it now. The end of it was bound to come. Even in Mariposa, some of the people must have thought so. Else how was it that Henry Mullins made such a fuss about selling a draft for $40,000 on New York? And why was it that Mr. Smith wouldn't pay Billy, the desk clerk, his back wages when he wanted to put it into Cuba? Oh yes, some of them must have seen it. And when it came, it seemed so quiet, ever so quiet. Not a bit like the Northern Star Mine and the Oyster Supper and the Mariposa Band. It's strange how quiet these things look the other way around. You remember the Cuban land frauds in New York and Porfirio Gomez shooting the detective and him and Maximo Morez getting clear away with $200,000? No, of course you don't. Why, even in the city papers it only filled an inch or two of type. And anyway, the names were hard to remember. That was Jeff's money, part of it. Mullins got the telegram from a broker or someone, and he showed it to Jeff just as he was going up the street with an estate agent to look at a big empty lot on the hill behind the town, the very place for those incurables. And Jeff went back to the shop, so quiet. Have you ever seen an animal that's stricken through? How quiet it seems to move? Well, that's how he walked. And since that, though it's quite a little while ago, the shop's open till 11 every night now. And Jeff is shaving away to pay back the $500 that Johnson, the livery man, sent to the Cubans. And, pathetic? Tut tut. You don't know the Pathetic? Tut tut. Pathetic? Tut tut. You don't know Mariposa. Jeff has to work pretty late, but that's nothing. Nothing at all if you've worked hard all your lifetime. And Myra is back at the telephone exchange. They were glad enough to see her, and she says now that if there's one thing she hates, it's the stage, and she can't see how the actresses put up with it. Anyway, things are not so bad. You see, it was just at this time that Mr. Smith's calf opened, and Mr. Smith came to Jeff's woman and said he wanted 7 dozen eggs a day, and wanted them handy. And so the hens are back, and more of them. And they exult so every morning over the eggs they lay, that if you wanted to talk of Rockefeller in the barber shop, you couldn't hear his name for the cackling. End of chapter 2.